Thank you. We will call this meeting of the Commerce Committee to order. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Representative Davids, I think you were the first one here. Have you had a chance to review the minutes for last committee hearing?
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the minutes of March 7th.
Thank you. Representative Davids moves those minutes. Members, are there any questions on those? Seeing none, all those in favor of the approval of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion is approved. Thank you, Representative Davids, for your enthusiastic approval of the minutes. With that, we are going to proceed with the first bill on the agenda, House File 2683. That is Representative Gottwalt. I will move House File 2683 so it is properly before the committee. And Representative Gottwalt, welcome to the committee, and please proceed when you're ready to go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A1 amendment. I'm sorry, I can't move it.
Well, that's
you
okay.
Needs to move it forward.
I will move the A1 amendment, and I assume that that's an amendment that gets the bill in the shape the author would like it to be in?
It does.
Okay. Do you want to briefly tell us what the A1 amendment is?
This amendment adds the word individuals and also defines dependent better. This is some cleanup language. We've been working on this for quite a while. It helps add a couple of things that were missing before.
Thank you. Members, any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Thank you, Representative Gottwalt, to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, what you have before you is a bill to create a tool that, along with other things that Minnesota does well, helps move us forward in the area of health care reform and particularly health care coverage. Minnesota is fifth in the nation for the number of part-time employees. We know that that is a barrier to insurance for a number of people. Small employers have a hard time helping part-time employees right now. What this allows members, this account, unified personal health savings, health premium account, is the opportunity for multiple sources, including multiple employers and perhaps the state, perhaps charitable organizations or others, to put money into an account that is individual to each person so that they can then pay a premium on an individual health policy, private insurance. We think it's a useful tool, innovative, first of its kind in the nation, and would be very helpful here in the state of Minnesota, regardless, members, of what happens over the next several months. Once again, it's a great Minnesota idea, and we hope you can support it. Mr. Chair, I have Mr. Peter Nelson from the Center for the American Experiment here to kind of walk us through some of the nuts and bolts.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Welcome to your committee, If you could identify yourself for a record, and please start when you're ready. And could you spell your last name?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Thanks. Chair.
I've always wanted to say that to someone named Nelson. So.
It would be Nelson. Of course, if I was back in Sweden, it would be Nilsson. But we are not in Sweden anymore. My name is Peter Nelson. I'm the Director of Public Policy at Center of the American Experiment. And I'll just walk through a few slides here. And as we all know, healthcare costs are continuing to be a challenging problem, and for a whole host of reasons that we all understand. A lot of people just have part-time employment. A lot of people are lower moderate income. A lot of people have cash flow issues. We have problems with affording healthcare. We all know that. And one of the consequences of our problems with health, of affording health care, is that fewer and fewer businesses are actually providing health care to their employees. When you look at the statistics, it's pretty remarkable when we see from 2001 to 2011, the number of employers that, the number of people that gain insurance coverage through their employers dropped from 68.1% to 56.4%. That is a substantial drop over just 10 years. Now, of course, fewer people without employer coverage means more people are on our public programs and more people are uninsured. And these days, when you're looking at employers, especially certain employers, they're often just presented with a very stark choice. Either I continue offering insurance benefits or I accept a 20 to possibly even 40% rate increase. And that's just not a choice that we should be expecting employers to make these days. Employers need more choices. And this concept here is trying to move us towards a place where employers have more choices. We all need more choices when it comes to our health care. So HF 2683 makes it possible for more people to afford health care by basically creating an opportunity to pool money together from multiple sources. And one of the ways it does, one of the key ways it does this is by allowing people to pool money from multiple employers. A lot of people have multiple part-time jobs, and the recent statistics that we've seen, I believe, that were just out last week on the uninsured, shows that 20% of the uninsured in Minnesota have multiple jobs. That's for this year, for 2011. In 2009, that was more like around 10%. So we've seen a dramatic jump. Obviously, that has a lot to do with where we are in our economy right now, and that number might drop as the economy improves, but a lot of people have multiple jobs, and on top of those people that have multiple jobs themselves, you have people who are married, and you have multiple job situations through marriage. And so we believe that there's opportunities to provide more people with better opportunities to gain access to health care if there were an account where they could actually pool money together to afford insurance premium, probably more or less on the individual insurance market, but we don't limit it to the individual insurance market. Someone could use this money to purchase a small group plan or a larger group plan if, say, their spouse had that plan, but they didn't have that plan. Ooh, look at that. That's not how it looked on my computer.
Maybe you have to advance it. There you go.
Oh, there we go.
It's animated.
I didn't know I animated it. So this is basically a diagram of how we believe this can work. On the left side, you see the personal health premium account funding possibilities. From employers, we're probably looking at funding opportunities that would be made available through what are called health reimbursement arrangements. These are arrangements where you can receive tax-preferred money to purchase, to pay for your health care, health benefits, to pay for your health insurance premiums. And one thing that a lot of people don't recognize is that these can actually be funded arrangements. Usually in the marketplace, a health reimbursement arrangement is just a reimbursement arrangement where if you pay for insurance, you just get reimbursed from your employer, and it's not from an account that's funded that accumulates. But there is possibilities to have a funded account that accumulates from year to year. And we believe that that is one of the key tools we can use to create this account where you have multiple employers with moving HRA funds into this account, and where you can combine it, so it's an easy way for the employee to control the money and direct it to the insurance plan of their choice. And that's the other aspect of this. It gives the individual much more choice and control over their insurance dollars, and ultimately it brings them to insurance ownership. And we think that's something that we should be promoting right now, and we think that is one of the more positive outcomes of this legislation.
Hang on, Mr. Nielsen, hang on. Representative Johnson. Why don't we go ahead?
On that last slide, I'm just trying to figure out a little bit. How is that different from just a regular savings account then? I mean, why wouldn't one just save like that?
Mr. Nelson.
It's different from a regular savings account because it's a trust account. It has to be a trust account because you have to have restrictions on how the money is used. In order to gain the tax advantages, we have to be sure that that money is going to pay for a health insurance premium.
Representative Johnson, follow-up? Okay. Thank you. Mr. Nelson, please proceed.
So those are the basics of how this account will work. And some of the other benefits that we're going to see is that it allows a defined contribution arrangement to be made. And so for a part-time employee that might have a job at Target, might have a job at Champs, they'll be able to accumulate these funds, and the Target and Champs will know exactly what they're going to be spending from month to month on this employee's health care and from year to year. They'll know that we've set our amount, and that's going to give them some security in their budgeting for health care moving forward. There are a whole number of other benefits to this that will accrue to the individuals, and we'll basically find it easier to access and maintain health insurance coverage. So instead of employers dropping coverage when they find that 30 or 40% premium increase, they can actually move to a different situation where they're just making a defined contribution for these employees. And many employers that don't offer coverage and cannot afford a group policy, there's a lot of employers out there that aren't offering coverage, This creates a new opportunity for them to step in and do something that they're not doing right now. Individuals also have more choice and control, as I discussed. Coverage will be more portable from job to job. And finally, coverage can be maintained if the individual is forced to leave their job due to illness. That's another really important thing to point out here. If you have group coverage right now and you become ill and you can't work, you are more likely to lose your coverage than if you had individual coverage in the first place. Because if you have individual coverage that's not tied to your employer, you can continue paying those premiums and continue that health insurance policy and have security in your illness. And with that, we'll take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Members, Representative Johnson.
I have a question about line 3.14 through 3.16, where it talks about a contributor to the account may restrict the use of funds the contributor contributes to the payment of premiums and so forth. What is the point of that?
Representative Gottwald.
What's that about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, it's a good question. Part of the reason we need to restrict the use of the funds is that if it's a public program, for example, the Healthy Minnesota Contribution Program, kind of a privatization of Minnesota Care, if it's state dollars going in, the state has to know that that money is being sequestered for use for the state program. There may be specific rules about coverage that are germane only to that state program. So you got to be able to say it's only going to be used for that. The private sector example, that would be, maybe grandma wants to contribute to a young grandson or granddaughter's health care coverage. And they want to make sure that money in that trust is only being sequestered for a particular purpose. So that's the main reason for that being set up that way.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gottwald, could you then, a contributor, restrict, let's say, if somebody wanted to purchase birth control or whatever the case, we hear about all these things on TV these days about restrictions that certain folks want to put on people's health care coverage. Would that also be a possibility?
Representative Gottwald?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I think that's exactly the point I made a moment ago, and I don't think that's the purpose. The reason is you have to, in many instances, be able to allow people contributing their dollars, whether it's the state or a private entity, to say that it's for specific kinds of coverage. In most cases, I think private contributions are simply going to be to allow someone to purchase what's already available in the private marketplace.
Representative Johnson, you...
In other words, that's not the purpose for that section. It's a more open tool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then, President Gottwald, could an employer then restrict what a person wanted to do with his health care coverage based on the fact that he's contributing?
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, this is dollars for health care coverage. So, again, this is pooling resources to pay for coverage. If they're pulling it from multiple sources, can they sequester some funds for certain purposes? Again, if it's under a state program and that's really the purpose of this, you'd almost have to. Maybe Mr. Nelson can answer whether or not we...
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the purpose of the restriction isn't tied to the benefits. I think that's an important point to make. We're talking about restrictions on what sort of health insurance product you could purchase. And people might use funds for a long-term care insurance policy or a major medical policy. But there's a lot of good reasons that employers would want to make sure that employees only contribute to a major medical policy. And that's the sort of restrictions that we're thinking about right here.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Gottwald, I was going to ask if I could get on this bill, but I guess I'm already on it, on this one. This is a brilliant, brilliant idea. I just am so surprised that I wasn't the one that thought of it. Couple questions. First of all, if you could go back to the slide where you have the health premium accounts, and I see that we're saying premium, could it be where, okay, you got the flow for premiums, so grandma can put in, the state could put in, a couple employers could put in, and like I said, I don't think we're talking about what coverage, because you're probably just going to go buy a Blue Cross or a Medica or a Health Partners type plan, which is probably going to cover all the things that Representative Johnson was talking about anyways, so I don't think that's the purpose of this, But, okay, so it can pay the premiums. Is there any way we can get it so if there's enough put in there that it could go towards a deductible, if you had a higher deductible plan, kind of like a hybrid of a premium account and a health savings account?
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, real briefly. By the way, thanks for being on the bill, and we'll give you credit for part of the idea.
Well, I'll take full credit.
Yeah, I know you will, but in the interest of full disclosure. Real quickly, give me the question again.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's called a personal health premium account. And I think it's brilliant in that, I mean, some people would like to help out, but they really have no mechanism to do that. And so a couple questions. First of all, is the person, let's say grandma puts in for a grandchild, would that be deductible for grandma?
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, what we talked about originally with this bill is creating what we wanted to call a super HSA. So you could use it for premiums, you could use it for eligible medical expenses, you could do a lot of that kind of stuff. We chose, because the HSA mechanism already exists, to focus on premium, because what we're really trying to do is get people access to health care coverage. So we have restricted this to premiums, but we could see in the future where this mechanism could be used to not only cover premiums but also eligible medical expenses that are not covered under health insurance.
Representative Davids.
Well, Mr. Chairman, why couldn't you go across there and have the PHPA funding grid there, and then way over on the right for the insurance ownership, why couldn't it be an HSA? So the premiums are going in part would go towards the premium for the insurance, and the rest would go for the HSA.
Representative Gottwald. Mr. Nelson, you see what happens when you give them a little credit?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are rules that restrict how HRAs can be used and how HRA funds can be used. And when you start to mix HRA funding with an HSA and with other sort of arrangements like flexible spending accounts, you start running into some problems under the tax code. And so using an HRA to fund an HSA, we have chosen right now not to go there.
Okay, Mr. Chair, one last question. So let's say we don't do an HRA or an HSA. We just go by Blue Cross Simply Blue. Okay, we go by that. And it has a $3,000 deductible. Can some of the money on the left there, we know it's going for premium, but some of that actually go for the deductible also?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, it wouldn't. Well, no, because right now we've restricted this to premiums. So you can't use this to pay your out-of-pocket costs. And as Representative Gottwald did mention, though, you know, we could foresee that possibility. But right now we've chosen to restrict it to premiums for a few different reasons. One of them, just simplicity's sake and just getting something started. But yeah, in the future you could possibly have that mechanism. And as far as the health savings account is concerned, contributions to a health savings account that themselves would be tax deductible. And so you could, when you put an administrator in charge of this, they have a lot of flexibility to develop different benefit options. And so you'll notice here on this diagram, you have PHPA funding possibilities. And in the next box, you have outside funding possibilities. There are ways to coordinate things. And so there are ways to coordinate a mechanism where you could have this account where the individual has some control over, but if there's not enough money in that account to pay your insurance premium, you could then have an arrangement where the employer also has a Section 125 plan where the employee can take a wage deduction and apply that to their premium as well.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, one more thing here.
Representative Davids.
To Mr. Nelson, okay, on the left there, let's say that grandma's got boatloads of money. I mean, she's made out like a bandit. She's got all sorts of bucks. Can you overfund the left side? What happens if you have so much money in there are there limits on what you can have on the left side?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, there are not limits right now. But I want to also make a clear point that there are tax-preferred dollars and there's non-tax-preferred dollars. Contribution from grandma would not be tax-advantaged. She can't take a tax deduction for contributing to your health care. And a charity, I think generally, you know, it would come from a charity, so that wouldn't be taxed itself. Certain contributions from the individual wouldn't be tax-preferred contributions. when it comes to the account, the tax preferred contributions are generally coming from the employer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chair Gottwalt, you got a great bill here.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Gottwalt. I'm listening to this. The questions here. I guess the question I have is, what happens to the money that gets put in there, and what happens if, say, XYZ employer that I'm working for, or three employers I'm working for, are putting money into this account, and I can't afford to buy to put my own money up to buy a health care premium? What happens to that money that's in there? Does it just stay in there? Does it disappear? I know some forms of health savings account, you put the money in at the end of the year. If you don't spend them, it disappears and goes back to the employer, and you just lose that money. So how is this funding going to work in here? Is it going to carry on, or if I can't afford to do it, is it just going to be gone for me, and you know, I still won't have health insurance?
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the money stays in there. It's specifically designed for premiums only. So the money has to go for paying a health insurance premium. As we've mentioned already, it's allowing for pooling of money that currently isn't being allowed to be pooled to pay that kind of thing. If there weren't enough to afford a health insurance policy, it's still there to help with that affordability. But you can't take the money and use it for something else. The employers don't control these dollars either. These dollars are set aside in a trust for the individual. So unlike a Section 125 plan where if you don't use it, you lose it, it goes back to the employer, that's not the case here. The dollars put in remain in the trust to be used to help pay health insurance premiums in perpetuity.
Representative Nelson, does that cover your question?
So, Mr. Chair, I guess I just clarify for my mind. So they put this money in there in my name. I can't afford to add on. It's not enough to cover for a health care premium. It stays in there in my name, so at some time in the future I could use this money, but it doesn't disappear. It would be there in perpetuity, I guess is the word I'm looking for.
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, that's correct.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just two quick questions, because I sent the bill to a friend of mine that does this sort of thing, and he read it, and his take on it was that if folks want to get together and pool money on behalf of, you know, so if Representative Anseltz and Representative Lilly and I want to purchase or put money in a pool or a bank account for Representative Hoppe's health insurance, his take was that there's nothing that would prevent that right now. Is there something that this does that wouldn't currently be allowed?
Let's be careful with our answer here. I like this idea.
Yeah, that's why you were the subject.
That's right. Representative Gottwald.
The chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, good question and a good point. My initial response, I'm going to have Mr. Nelson respond to it in greater detail, but this is not currently happening. And it's not happening because you'd have to hire a bunch of attorneys to try to set up the same kind of mechanism. And most small employers or individuals don't have the cash to go out and hire an attorney to set this kind of mechanism up so they can start pooling dollars.
So it's possible, if you don't represent, it's possible now, it just doesn't, it's technically possible, it just doesn't happen. Representative Davids.
I don't think it is technically possible right now, because you could do the lower, you know, you can do family individual charity probably, or not, maybe not even charity, but you couldn't do employer one and employer two.
Right.
Unless this is set up.
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, you could, but it would take a lot of legal stuff. You'd have to put a lot of paperwork in place.
Mr. Nelson, do you want to weigh in?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. There's some of this that certainly is possible currently, but there are a lot of obstacles to certain things happening. And one of the major obstacles is the fact that multiple employers aren't going to get together and make these arrangements together. You're not going to, we don't see Champs and Target getting in the same room to set up an arrangement so that they have a standardized agreement where the employees are able to accept certain amounts of funding. But there are also some other legal obstacles that this is moving towards addressing, and that's, there are also some fiduciary duties under ERISA that are required of employers, and this sort of makes this situation more clear as to where some of those liabilities might lie. And so, you know, there's a lot of those sorts of issues that this attempts to clarify.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I the purpose is laudable. I just wanted to be clear that that it was entirely possible right now, under current law, to do exactly what you're proposing. And because otherwise, I would have gone back to my friend Dave and challenged him a little bit about it. But his take was, particularly among small employers, if they share an employee, that this is something that is, if not routine, it's something that they certainly are able to do right now. My other question, Mr. Chair, and Representative Gottwald, does this meet the federal mandate for a health exchange? This is described loosely as a health exchange bill. Does it meet the federal mandate?
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, I don't know anybody who's described it as that except perhaps you here in committee, but as I pointed out earlier, this is a useful tool for Minnesota regardless of what happens now in the next several months or whatever. And I would add, you know, Minnesota is capable of doing an awful lot right now without a lot of the other things that might be coming our way. So I don't know, Representative Atkins. I noticed that the Obama administration has been for more and more, it seems like every week we get a new notice about new flexibility for states to kind of meet our needs our own way. And, you know, who knows?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the answer, and not to put words in your mouth, Representative Gottwald, is you don't know. And I think that's a fair, if that's the case, that's fine. I just want to make certain, though, that the way things currently stand is unless we set up the framework for a state-run health insurance exchange, then as of January 1st, 2013, the federal government will do it for us. And that's why, and it's, I know this has gotten to be a really politically charged, you know, if you're on one side or the other, whatever, but the point is I really don't want to have the federal government create a health exchange for us. And I see you're shaking your head that you don't want them to create a health insurance exchange for us either. That's why I was hoping that we could have some clarity whether or not this bill as it stands would satisfy that requirement. Because if it doesn't, then I think that we should do something to ensure that the feds don't do a health exchange for us. And if you'd care to comment about your thoughts on that, that's fine. If you don't, that's fine too. I just thought it bore some mention as we start talking about things along these lines. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Representative Gottwald, did you want to comment that? Okay. And Representative Atkins, I'll get you my personal information later, and I appreciate very much your guys' contribution.
Please include your Social Security number, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The guy does it on the radio. I might as well. Representative Johnson.
I'll pass.
No, Representative Van Zels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gottwald, there are two really large publicly funded health care programs in Minnesota, one for the poor people whose income eligibility determines eligibility for medical assistance, mm-hmm. and long-term care after spend down and all of that ends up being a huge chunk of that medical assistance program, which is paid for federal, state, and some local levy at the county level. Mm-hmm. And then there's Medicare, which I'm going to be eligible for pretty quick, and that's for old timers.
Careful.
I just, you know, I see some merit here, but I wonder how those populations eligible for those two very complex programs access information, access what services they're eligible for, and how they navigate this all under your bill.
Representative Gottwald.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Van Zelks, thanks for asking. You make a very good point. Eligibility right now is determined in a variety of ways. This bill is a tool specifically for people who are looking for a resource, a mechanism for pooling resources for private health insurance coverage. So this would not apply to medical assistance. It could apply to Medicare. it could apply to long-term care coverage. We've been talking a lot in this legislature about how do we give people the incentive and the resources to plan better for their own long-term care needs so we're not constantly pushing them onto MA. It's something that we don't think we can, frankly, sustain financially. One of the uses of this money in this account would be to help pay for the premium of a long-term care coverage policy. So it is one tool. It doesn't necessarily, and I'm not quite sure what you're asking it to do at this point. It is not part of a public program per se. It's meant to help people collect resources to pay for private insurance.
Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gottwald, so your answer is you're not sure how this is going to impact services for the elderly, the Medicare eligible population. And as far as medical assistance is concerned, I heard you mention we can't sustain medical assistance in its current form. So what happens with medical assistance for income-eligible Minnesotans who fall below income guidelines?
Representative Gottwald.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Manziel, this bill doesn't purport to solve all problems. I sure wish I had that kind of silver bullet for health care reform and health care coverage. But as was pointed out very early in the presentation, it does help a significant section of the uninsured in the state of Minnesota pool resources so that they can afford health care coverage. It's not going to solve the entire equation for medical assistance. It's not going to solve the entire equation for Medicare. But we need to start putting together these kinds of tools. And frankly, this is a nonpartisan issue. This isn't meant to be a shot in the side of anybody. I don't see any reason why Democrats and Republicans wouldn't sign on to this bill and why Governor Dayton wouldn't sign it.
Representative Anzo.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that, Representative Gottwald. Unfortunately, I see less coverage, less eligibility, less services, sick people getting sicker, people already having trouble navigating the public system, having catastrophic difficulty navigating it, and a Minnesota citizenry that is sicker, not healthier.
Representative Gottwald, did you want to respond?
Well, briefly, Mr. Chair and Representative Anzo, we actually have a part of this presentation that we haven't gotten to yet where we'd like to show some of the tools that are available right now, but maybe now would be a good time to do that.
Well, Representative Gottwald, we're going to be running short of committee time, and my strong guess is that there are a couple of people that want to speak against this bill. I could be wrong, but why don't we go ahead to other members. Representative Nelson, did you have another question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess looking at the bill, too, and I'm curious, what are the repealers in it, and what are they doing? I mean, I got a little note here from our staff that what the repealers do, and why are they necessary to make this bill go forward? I mean, the one looks like it prohibits employers from encouraging their employees not to submit health care claims, and the other one prevents insurance agents from trying to break up small groups of employees to sell them insurance. So why is this repealer necessary to make this bill go forward?
Representative Gottwald.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, great question. We have been talking, and you heard earlier in the presentation, about some of the challenges of group coverage. If there are small businesses in the audience, they know what they're experiencing under small group coverage. The double-digit increases, the retrospective look back that results in those kinds of increases through experience, we believe that one of the answers to the equation is allowing people the resources and ability to purchase individual coverage. We hear about that bipartisanly. The ability of people to purchase individual coverages using these kinds of tools, we can do that in a manner that allows for portability, for rate stabilization for individuals, and for appropriate coverage. And we think the time has come to stop this gag rule that prevents us from exploring those models. More and more we're talking about that. How can we get people their own individual coverage that stays with them as long as they pay the premium? It's theirs as long as they live. And Representative Van Zelt talked to that earlier. I mean, access to coverage that doesn't let you go and that allows you to go from job to job or situation to situation. We have in statute right now language that stops that from happening. And so we feel that it's arcane. Working with this kind of tool, it can actually help provide better coverage to individuals and in a more portable way.
Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as you say that, I guess to me, an easier way to do that would be to take this, give this money that's going into this fund to the employees as part of their wages, and then give the employees what currently the employers have is the tax write-off when they buy insurance. If you could give that to the employees right now as an employee, I don't get that, but give that as a take it off your income. I give you this to pay it by health insurance. You buy health insurance, you take it off, and you're not taxed on that. I think that would be a simpler way of doing this and encouraging people to buy health insurance, an individual policy that they could take with them. A lot of what you describe here in this plan sounds a lot like the insurance plan I've been in most of my life, but that's a Taft-Hartley plan where we have multiple employers paying in. I work this week for employer A, and I work this next week for employer B. They all pay into the same fund for the hours that I work, and I get coverage that way. That's how it works in the building trades. But I think an easier way to do this, what you're trying to do here, is give the money to the employee as a part of their wages, and then give them the tax break so that when they buy the insurance, they get that tax break that employers now get, and then they buy their insurance.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, this is actually, I'm glad you brought up the union situation, because we actually are, this actually does try to facilitate something like you just talked about. In the current federal law, though, it really makes it easy for unions to do this. It doesn't make it easy in a non-collectively bargained environment to do this. And we are trying to facilitate this in a non-collectively bargained agreement. Collectively bargained agreements are free from a lot of different rules under the federal tax code and from under ERISA. And so this is basically trying to bring us to actually a point where there's some sort of equity between the collectively bargained environment and the non-collectively bargained environment. And to your point on, you know, how employers often do it, employers do often do set up a defined contribution arrangement where they just deduct it through a Section 125. And that's great for a lot of situations. But it's not great for every situation. And we're trying to create yet another choice and option for different situations. When you're talking about a Section 125 plan has to be used in the year it's paid out. And if you only get $50 a month, then that may be fine. But if you want to accumulate resources for future expenses, that doesn't work.
Representative Nelson, did you have a follow-up to that? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, this is the first I've seen this bill, but from what I understand, in talking to my constituents, what they're interested in is more affordable health care where they can actually afford it. But what I understand from this bill, which, you know, for better or worse, it doesn't really deal with that end of things. It's essentially suggesting a way for people to save in a way that's going to provide them more money to purchase insurance. But there's no, I mean, you deleted Section 5 about the Marketplace Website Task Force. It doesn't do anything with respect to competition within that healthcare industry to provide healthcare more affordable or anything of that sort.
Representative Gottlieb.
Am I understanding that correct?
Well, Mr. Chair.
And if it does, let me know how it makes it more affordable.
Representative, we already have a competitive marketplace, and the issue for a lot of people is that they are unable to get the resources together to afford the health care coverage that's already available. And we haven't added up the cost of doing things differently. You know, government-mandated price levels don't necessarily work too well either, as we've seen. It ends up getting passed on to providers or others and destroying access to care. So I think again, this tool is what it is. It's meant to help people afford health care coverage.
Representative Johnson, you're...
No, I think you said what I thought it was.
Thank you. Representative Van Zyls.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gottwald, as you move forward here and attempt to duplicate the good things that have been done through Taft-Hartley, for the building trades unions and their health care and try to duplicate it and learn through the experience of the labor movement working with employers, try not to do any harm, because under the current Taft-Hartley arrangement, those signatory employers are also eligible for the same identical health care program that their employees are entitled to. The only difference is that it's negotiated. It's a negotiable item at the bargaining table, and it works well. And so I'm encouraged that you want to duplicate this for the non-unionized element as well.
Thank you, Representative Anzels. And members, I think we've had a pretty good discussion here, and I think this is probably a good point to see if there's anyone in the audience that wants to come down and speak against the proposal before us. Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Braze. If you could identify yourself for the tape, and please start when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and I am pleased to say that the Section 5 has been removed from the bill. This was of great concern to us because this was the health insurance exchange portion of the bill. I do want to say that we like the idea of the insurance ownership that's part of the bill. I want to say that we like the idea that we're taking away the gag rule in Section 6. The only concern that we have left, and I have already talked with Representative Gottwalt about this, is the piece in Section 4, which has to do with agreement. And the fact that it's an open agreement that can be made leads us to believe that it's entirely possible because of how the Healthy Minnesota program language is. Currently, it requires the money to go from the Department of Human Services directly to the health plan. So it would be impossible for it to just stop and be waylaid at the trust fund. And therefore, I think it would be a better idea if you just change the Healthy Minnesota program language or add special language to Section 4 of this that makes it clear that it's just not an open ability to make an agreement. Because that agreement could say something like the only way you're going to get the money is through a health insurance exchange. And we just want to make sure that that doesn't happen. And initially, I was coming here to oppose the bill because of Section 5. And in case you all haven't heard, the newest health insurance exchange rules, interim final rules, have been published. They were published yesterday. They are 644 pages long. There are more than 300 uses of the word require, and there's 1,004 uses of the word must. So that if any state puts in an exchange, they are required to do what the feds say, no matter what. So that's why we were opposing it, and now I'm just hoping that the agreement language will be switched so we don't have to have any opposition to it in the future.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Members, any questions? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the crowd that wants to come down and speak for or against this bill? Not seeing anyone coming down. Representative Gottwalt, we'll give you the final word.
It's a great idea. I hope you'll vote green.
Thank you, Representative Gottwalt. We like brevity. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 2683, as amended, be approved and passed and sent to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
No.
Motion prevails. The motion is passed and sent on to the Committee on Taxes. Thank you, Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, members, for a good discussion on that bill. Representative Grunhagen, come on down, and we're going to go with number two on the agenda, House File 2345. Representative Grunhagen, welcome to the committee.
Employers can already.
Representative Mazerall, would you be interested in moving House File 2345 for Representative Grunhagen?
I so move, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mazerall. Members, House File 2345 is before us. Representative Grunhagen, welcome to the committee, and please proceed. And let's see if you can beat Representative Gottwalt in the brevity department.
I'll try.
Our money's on you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What House File 2345 does, it creates a statute between the Affordable Care Act and the private insurance market so that we can maintain a viable individual health insurance market here in the state of Minnesota. Minnesotans do best when they have many insurance options from which to choose. As a result, Minnesota's insurance carriers have long provided many health insurance choices for our residents. That is why a carrier offers dozens of plans with varying deductibles, co-pays, co-insurance, and networks. Because of the competition, carriers are constantly working to find new plans to make owning health insurance more affordable and provide maximum access to care. Competition among private carriers is good for Minnesota and good for its citizens. We believe the legislature should make sure that a vibrant, competitive private insurance marketplace continues to grow. The Affordable Care Act of 2010 creates the real possibility that competition in the private insurance market will be limited by the rules concerning health plans that may be offered in a health insurance benefit exchange. Whether the Minnesota legislature passes an exchange bill is unknown. What is known is that the ACA requires an exchange. We must protect the private insurance markets. Insurance plans offered in exchange are defined as qualified health plans. The ACA defines a qualified health plan as a plan certified by the Federal Secretary of Health and Human Services for sale in an exchange. The ACA allows exchanges to offer qualified health plans inside and outside of the exchange, but the plans must be identical and priced the same. The ACA allows states to maintain a private insurance market outside of the exchange. It is up to Minnesota legislature to ensure the private market can survive and grow. A thriving marketplace brings competition to bear in two significant ways. First, the private market plans will compete with each other outside of the exchange. This will maximize plan design and premium rates within the restrictions of Minnesota law and encourage innovation among health plans to win a market share. For any exchange to achieve its ACA goals of increased health plan competition, the exchange needs real competition from health plans outside of the exchange. This is a simple bill with a profound impact. The bill will protect a competitive private health insurance marketplace by defining two types of health insurance plans allowed to be offered in Minnesota. The qualified health plans sold inside and outside of the exchange at the discretion of the Exchange Board of Governance and controlling statutory language. The second option, non-qualified health plans, to be sold outside of the exchange. A non-qualified health plan is a health insurance policy that has not been certified by the Secretary to be sold in exchanges and that does not conform to all other Minnesota and federal statutory requirements for health insurance. But does conform to all other Minnesota and federal statutory requirements.
Representative Grunhagen, are you just about through with your statement? I want to get to Mr. DiTillo and member of the Gottwald thing.
Yep.
Mr. DiTillo, welcome to the committee. Please.
Well, I thought if I was thorough, you wouldn't have any questions. Okay.
No, and we appreciate that. Well, Mr. DiTillo, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape, please proceed when you're ready.
My name is Greg DiTillo. I'm president of the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters. Our profession currently enrolls and services around 2.5 million Minnesotans in health insurance across the state. We support this bill to continue to have a vibrant private market outside of Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange. It was created under the Affordable Care Act. As Ms. Twyla Brace just stated, here's the new regulations as of yesterday on the exchange, 644 pages. Now, this here is, there's actually another book the same size that was created back here in July with other regulations. So we expect more novel length volumes of regulations prior to 2014. Well, this bill, House File 2345, will prevent the federal government from controlling and over-regulating the Minnesota private market. That's what we're concerned about, because this type of regulation will definitely bury the private market as we see it now. So today our private market is regulated with our own Minnesota regulators through the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Today it works, and we must take measures now to keep it working. Passing House File 2345 into law will ensure the private market will not be smothered by over-abusive regulation from Washington. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. DiTillo. Members, any questions? You are very thorough, Representative Grunhagen and Mr. DiTillo. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the crowd that wants to come down and testify for or against this bill? Welcome, sir. Welcome back to the committee, and identify yourself to the for the record, and please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jay McLaren, and I'm the Director of Government Relations at Medica. And today I'm testifying on behalf of Medica, Blue Cross, Blue Shield of Minnesota, and also Health Partners. We are testifying in support of this bill. We believe that it's important for many of the reasons that were already stated to enact it. There are a couple things to point out that I'd like to talk about today. One of the things is that with qualified health plans, they can only be offered by insurance companies that meet the requirements of the exchange. And then the products that we offer as qualified health plans also have to meet the requirements of the exchange. These qualified health plans have to meet federal requirements, and they may be subject to new regulations on the part of the board that governs the exchange as well. So there are two additional layers of regulations for these qualified health plans. We support this bill because it would guarantee that consumers in Minnesota would have access to products that would not have to meet these requirements of the federal government or of the exchange board, and but would still continue to have to meet the requirements of state law that you folks enact and that the Department of Commerce regulates. So that's my testimony. I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. McLaren. Members, any questions for Mr. McLaren? Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? Ms. Braze, welcome back. Please once again identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes, Twyla Braze, President, Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and my testimony is very simple. We just don't want to see any piece of the Affordable Care Act codified into state law. And I know that people want to have protections against it, but it's our concern, especially as we're not even having decided the constitutionality of it. Our concern is for actually having any kind of language in that could be perhaps a vehicle for other language. So that is my my simple testimony. We would really like to keep all the language out from being codified into law.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Brace, you keep talking about the Affordable Health Care Act, and you don't want any language in it because you feel it's unconstitutional. What happens if in June or so when the Supreme Court comes out, what if they do declare it constitutional? What are you going to say then?
Ms. Brace.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, you know, it's kind of interesting because there was just an article in Politico talking about what states might decide to do if it were ruled constitutional. And one of the attorney generals from Virginia, Ken Cuccinelli, said, and I am obviously paraphrasing, but he basically said that, you know, there's no criminal offense here, and now it just becomes a matter of power. So it's a standoff. So what we would like states to remember and what state legislators to remember is that is the 10th Amendment, which is states' rights. And I remember, I can't remember exactly who did it. I think it was maybe Daniel Webster way back when. And maybe it was around the Constitutional Convention talking about whether or not really everybody should trust their constitutionality to six men in black robes, I think is how he talked about it. So at some point it really becomes state legislators remembering what the 10th Amendment says and that all powers that are not enumerated in the Constitution are reserved to the states. And it will become probably an interesting time in the history of our country.
Members, any other questions? Is there anyone else that wants to come down and speak for or against the bill? Seeing none, Representative Grunhagen will give you the final word.
Well, thank you, members, Mr. Chair, for the presentation. I would just add one comment. Sometimes the Affordable Care Act has been seen as a partisan issue, okay? And I just want to say this. When we look at the development of the Affordable Care Act, its roots have both Republican and Democrat fingerprints on it, okay? So I believe it's the solutions can be bipartisan, because the start of the federal Affordable Care Act started in Massachusetts with a Republican governor. So I don't see this as a partisan issue. I see this as us as Minnesota citizens wanting to give our citizens as much competition in health care as possible versus a one-size-fits-all. So I'd appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. With that, Representative Mazeral renews his motion that House File 2345 be passed and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails, and the House File 2345 is sent on its way to the General Register. Where Representative Grunhagen will go right with House File 2347. I will move House File 2347 to get it in front of the committee. Please proceed when you are ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I do have a delete all amendment that I'd like to move first to put the bill in the proper order, and I have one oral amendment.
Okay, hang on 1 second. I got to make sure I have the correct delete all amendment in front of me. Where's the delete all for this? It's here somewhere. So would this be the, just to make sure we're on the same page, 2347, the DE1 amendment?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I will move the DE1 amendment. And do you want to give the committee, before we vote on that, do you want to give us a brief explanation of what the delete all does?
What House File 2347 addresses is a inequity in the pricing of group insurance, especially in the 50 to 100 range. Currently, there are no limitations like there are in the 2 to 50 range in terms of premium increases. This would limit the premium increases up to 20% plus trend. It gives some relief to that 5,100 who have been suffering very high premium increases for their employees in the past several years. And we all know that the cost of health insurance and benefits can be a detriment to employees or employers adding new employees.
And Representative Grunhagen, is the oral amendment, I assume that's to the DE amendment?
Correct. It's just a technical change.
And where is that? Why don't we adopt that and incorporate that into the DE1?
Line 2.3.
Okay.
For the purposes of, right after of, for clarification purposes, such premium increases under this subdivision. So the technical amendment is such premium increases under this subdivision.
Okay, just Representative Grunhagen, where was that?
2.3.
Okay.
After the word of, insert such premium increases under. And then it would read, for the purposes of such premium increases under this subdivision. Is that clear?
Well, no. Representative Grunhagen, I think we're either looking at the wrong.
What did I say?
2.3.
Oh, thanks for the correction.
Okay. 2.30.
Correct.
Okay. So after the word of, what are we inserting?
Such premium increases under. Sorry for the confusion, Mr. Chair.
So the line 2.30 would read, for purposes of such premium increases under this subdivision.
Correct.
Do we have that? Mr. Pender, does that make sense? Does that work?
Mr. Chair, yes, it does.
Thank you. Members, any questions either to the oral amendment or to the DE1 amendment?
Do we know how Commerce feels about this?
Seen no questions. Representative Lilly, would you like to have someone from? Okay, just checking. Thank you. Okay. Members, seeing no other questions on the DE1 amendment with the oral amendment incorporated, I will. Go ahead and move that again. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Grunhagen, to your bill, and it looks like we have a visitor.
Yep.
Welcome, sir. Please identify yourself for the record and start when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chris Schneeman. I own a independent insurance agency here in St. Paul called Seven Hills Benefit Partners. I also serve as a legislative chairman for the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters. I'd like to speak in favor of this bill, particularly because of the references that Representative Grunhagen had, is that the employers that occupy that space that we are now referring to as larger small employers have typically been those employers that have gathered most of the headlines with regard to unfairness in premium increases and employers who are canceling their insurance because of a tragic episode within their own group. Could be a child being born, somebody, a spouse being diagnosed with a terrible illness. And those costs get passed currently directly back to that particular employer, causing many of the problems that we read about today. In the early 1990s, Minnesota addressed this problem with the small employer health reform laws at the time and created a very stable market for the employers that are now defined as between 2 and 50 employees. Let me give you a quick snapshot of why that market is much more stable. The small market has got rules that require insurance companies to guarantee issue to any employer that wishes to purchase in that marketplace. They also have to live within certain rate bands, so premiums can't exceed their midpoint premiums by 25%, nor can they be less than 25% below that midpoint. And they also have got a regulator that says that the rate renewal can't be more than 15% above that insurance company's trend number, right? And that's an annual limit on the increase. What this bill does is it takes that particular feature, the small employer rules, and applies it now to employers that have between 51 and 100 employees, okay? So it's a very soft step into premium stability into this particular marketplace. Which is really what we're trying to accomplish here. Minnesota has always led the country in terms of health insurance reform. I referenced the 1992 rules, the fact that we've had a Minnesota comprehensive health plan that's been around since 1976. We think it's time now that healthcare costs have accelerated to the degree that they have now that these mid-sized employers, which now we're defining as a larger, a small employer, deserve some protection as well. And with that, I'll take questions.
Thank you, sir. Members, any questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much. Is there anyone in the crowd that wants to come down and speak for or against this? Welcome back, Mr. McLaren. Is the fact that you have audio or visual assistance an indicator of anything?
No, just for myself, Mr. Chairman.
Got it. Well, please re-identify yourself for the record and start when you're ready.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Jay McLaren. I'm the Director of Government Relations at Medica. And this time I'm testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, which represents Minnesota's not-for-profit health plans. I first of all want to recognize and thank the author, Representative Grunhagen, for working with us on this bill and amendments. I appreciate him working with us. We'll continue to work with him on some of the concerns that we have with Section 2, but also want to thank him for Section 1, which we support. So on that Section 1, we understand this language to limit the small group market up to 50, which is important in relation to federal health care reform because that would make this would be the state making a statement that it will limit the small group market in 2014 and 2015 to up to 50. So we think that is a good idea. And then for Section 2, we continue to have concerns, but once again appreciate the author working with us on this. Just for folks' background, this is not a new issue to be brought before the legislature. This has been around for quite a few years, and talking to the proponents, this has been around for at least 5 years. In fact, about a year and a half ago, there was a group brought together by the legislature comprised of experts, including agents and brokers, insurers, small employers, employees, Department of Commerce, to look at this issue. And they looked at two different issues. One was the issue of pooling these folks, the 51 to 100 groups, into their own pool. and they recommended that the state not do that, so I appreciate that part of the bill has been removed. One of the other questions that they looked at was, should they expand the small group market to include the 51 to 100 employers? And they recommended that that not happen. So those were the recommendations that came from this task force just a year and a half ago. Also want to talk about some concerns that we have with the amount of time and expenses that this may take to comply with this new law. My understanding is right now for these groups, we only file for rates our methodology that we use and apply to these folks. In talking to the Department of Commerce and in order to comply with this, it's my understanding that they may require us to submit our actual trend numbers for this, depending on how this is interpreted, and then come out with some rate filings for these products. So that comes at some time and attention and expense on the part of our plans. If you remember the math majors that you may have known in college, some of them go on to NASA, some of them go on to working as math teachers, some of them also work as actuaries at our company or that we contract with. So these folks, a lot of their time and attention is going to be spent on looking at the requirements of federal health care reform and trying to help us figure out how those rates need to be set in 2014. This takes time away from that and adds some expense to having to come up with these rate filings for the Department of Commerce. We would also have a concern that that in this section 2, this new pricing arrangement would only be good for 3 years, 2013, 14, and 15, until we move to to community rating in 2016 for these groups. So it would only have, with those resources that we use, a limited shelf life for it. So that's my testimony, Mr. Okay. Chairman and members. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. McLaren. And members, I think what we're going to do right now is temporarily lay this bill over so Representative Grunhagen can leave us and go vote in another committee. Representative Grunhagen, if you want to go vote and come back down, and then we can take more testimony on this. But for right now, we will temporarily lay House File 2347 on the table while the author goes somewhere upstairs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, members. Representative Anderson. Portable electronics insurance sales regulated. Representative Anderson, if you want to move House File 2638 and then start explaining your bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 2638 so then pass this a committee and send it to the General Register. And Mr. Chairman, I do also have an amendment I'd like to offer.
Okay. Would you like to offer the amendment right now to get it in the shape you want the bill to be in?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. It should be in your packets. I have the A1 amendment.
Okay.
And this amendment is a concern from the Department of Commerce. So we're just going to be deleting this section of the bill due to their request.
Okay. So Representative Anderson moves the A1 amendment. Members, do we need more explanation than that? Does everyone have the A1 amendment? Looks like this. It's white with writing on it. Thought that'd be funnier. Does everybody have the A1 amendment? It was handed out. Does anybody have any questions about the A1 amendment? Why don't we go ahead and vote on that? All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Anderson, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 2638 amends the licensing requirements for the sale of portable electronics insurance. Portable electronics insurance coverage the loss or damage to a whole range of portable electronics devices, such as mobile telephones, iPads, and laptop computers. This coverage is typically sold by the sales staff for the vendor of an electronics device, such as a wireless carrier store or electronics retailer. In 2010, legislation was enacted licensing the vendor of the device to sell portable electronics insurance. In light of the rapid evolution of the sale of portable electronics insurance, revisions to this licensing system are already necessary. I have with me today Mr. Stephen McDaniel, and he's representing Assurian Protective to explain the bill for you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you could identify yourself for the record, please start when you're ready.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen McDaniel. I'm here on behalf of Assurian, one of the proponents of this piece of legislation. As the representative mentioned, the legislature passed a regulatory framework for offering this product in 2010. Since that time, the same or similar framework has been adopted in 26 other states. Really what this bill does is make amendments to the framework that was established in 2010 to bring it into a more consistent line with the other states as it's been adopted. So I think it addresses some of the growing pains in implementing the regulatory framework and makes it more streamlined for the department as well as the industry.
And thank you. And I'm sorry, did you say, I didn't catch it, was your name Mr. McDaniel?
Yes.
Okay, spelled conventionally?
S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Stephen,
okay.
M-T-D-A-N-I-E-L.
Got it. Thank you. Members, any questions? You have Representative Anderson, you have another testifier up there who's looking like he doesn't need to say anything. Always a wise choice. Just there in case he's needed. Mr. Reich, welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, John Reich from the Department of Commerce. We have had a number of conversations with the proponents of the legislation and have three outstanding issues, one of which was taken care of with the amendment today, and so we're very appreciative of that. And the other two, quickly, Mr. Chair, are on lines 3.27 through 3.29. And the proponents of the legislation are familiar with all of these, so it's nothing new. There's a provision for premium refunds, and we want to make sure that the refund goes back to the person paying the premium, whether that person's the customer or the vendor. In many cases, it's the customer. We want to just make sure that that ends up in the customer's pocket if they are, in fact, paying it. And then the second issue, Mr. Chair, is on lines 5.7 through 5.22. That provision deems provision of an email address during the course of a transaction as consent to correspond electronically with the vendor. And so we're working through some of the issues with the proponents to make sure that folks affirmatively consent or in some manner like that to receiving electronic notices as opposed to doing it unknowingly. Those are our concerns, Mr. Chair. We look forward to continue working with proponents and to see if we can get to, as Representative David says, peace in the veil.
Thank you, Mr. Reich, and I always appreciate hearing you say you're willing to work with the author. Representative Anderson, I assume that you're going to meet with Mr. Reich as soon as is practicable after this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we will.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Reich, on your two remaining concerns then on lines 3.27 and 3.29, the concern there is that the person who paid the premium should get the premium back. That's what it appears. I'm talking slowly. To me, that's what it appears to say, is that the person who paid the premium is actually the one who's getting the premium back. Maybe I'm just misreading it, but I think we're there on that one, unless you tell me otherwise. And maybe in a previous iteration, there might have been some concern.
Representative Atkins, can I had kind of a similar question, and I'm wondering, is that because sometimes the person that pays the premium isn't, in fact, the customer? Is that, or is this kind of taken care of like Representative Atkins said?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Reich.
Representative Atkins, Chair Hoppe, yes. The person, I'm not an attorney, but as I understand it, person can mean a number of different things in the law, and so we just want to simply... We're having the discussions, we want to just simply make sure that somebody who, if it is in fact a customer paying the premium, that they get the premium refund. So whether a person is the entity, a vendor, or whether it's another entity besides the customer, that the refunds are actually going to the customer, if in fact they are paying the premium.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, now
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Atkins.
I get it now, and I think between the, I'm confident you'll be able to work that piece of it out.
Mr. Chairman, I think we're willing to make an oral amendment on that issue before we go to the next issue, if you're willing to let me make an oral amendment.
Yeah, what the heck?
Is something you've got worked out with Mr. Reich, or do you want a moment while we're discussing the rest of the bill?
Mr. Chair, 5 seconds to read the...
One... Two,
you're like Jimmy
John.
Three.
Okay, I think we have an agreement, Mr. Chairman.
All right. What's the? You guys are good.
Line point. Well, they had discussions this afternoon. On line 3.29, we would like to change, instead of to the person paying the premium, it'll say to the customer paying the premium. So change person to customer.
Members, any questions? Everybody understand what we're doing? Everybody understand the change? No questions. All those in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The oral amendment is adopted. Representative Atkins, I believe you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just the final point. It looks like, I mean, we're rapidly getting there, and maybe this one's just a five-second deal, and then we can move on to the health insurance exchange, and Representative Anderson can solve that one in a few seconds or less. But on lines 5.16 through 5.19, if I'm reading that, and maybe, Mr. Reich, this is what you were alluding to, I'm one of those people that when I, and I think a lot of folks are, that I don't want my stuff coming paperless unless I say so. Bank statements, for example, I still like getting mine in the mail. And I'm just afraid, it's whether it's travel insurance or whatever, it really makes me feel good to be able to check a box. And I read this too rapidly, but it sounds like this one would, if I so much as provided my email address or corresponded via email, that suddenly everything goes paperless, and I don't get anything in the mail anymore. Am I reading that right? Because if that's the case, I think most consumers would probably have the same. Some of them might want to be completely paperless, but others would at least like to check the bin. I see Representative Crawford's kind of in the same boat. I like checking the box. If I want something, I'd like to opt in rather than have it done to me.
One, two, three. Mr. Reich or Representative Anderson, do you guys want a few moments? And
Chairman, I think this is an issue. We'll need a little bit more discussion. We'd like to work this out in the interim.
Okay.
This bill's going to move to the floor, but it hasn't been heard in the Senate either, so we can work on it there.
Mr. Reich, we have been a little more lax than we probably should have been on this committee, and I'm, frankly, the chief offender of that, of sending bills out of here that haven't been 100% smoothed out. Are you okay with that, Mr. Reich?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, they'd be fine with us. I actually have an inquiry into our staff attorney at the department as to what would constitute good language on this. So I'm waiting to hear back from her. I'd like the opportunity to continue to work.
I'm fine with that. I think, and just in looking at the expressions around the table, I don't think I was alone lots of folks are kind of right. Giving some sort of, I think people would be more comfortable if that issue was addressed so that you could check a box or something so your whole world doesn't go paperless without, but I'll leave it at that. I'm confident in the chief author and the department to figure something out. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. And I did know on line 5.9 it says either by mail or electronic means, but then farther down I think it does say where you pointed out that if you give them your email to get either by mail or electronic means, you're getting it by email. Yeah. So I think that's something that is workoutable, if that's a word.
Absolutely.
Workoutable, we like that.
It's a word.
You're the decider.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? Members, any questions? With that, seeing none, Mr. Reich, thank you for your willingness to work on this. Mr. Estenson, Representative Anderson. With that, Representative Anderson renews her motion that House File 2638, as amended, be recommended to pass and worked on before it gets there, but sent to the General Register. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, members.
We are on to Representative Mazerall, House File 2705. We have allotted 3 minutes for this bill.
Sure. You'd like me to?
I'm sad.
I'm not sure why I'm doing that.
This is 2705. Welcome, Representative Mazerall.
Thank you,
please,
Mr. Chair.
Please, if you'd like to go ahead and move your bill and start when you're ready.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, I move House File 2705 to recommend to pass and refer to the General Register. That's a question.
Sure. Unless you are aware, I have not heard from anyone that needs to go anywhere else, and Mr. Lake is signifying that it doesn't either. So with that, thank you. Representative Mazerall has moved 2705, so it's in front of us. With that, Representative Mazerall, two-year bill.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, there is a DE1 amendment.
Of course. Thank you. Representative Mazerall, would you like to move the DE1 amendment?
I will move the DE1 amendment.
Can you give us a quick thumbnail sketch of the DE1 amendment and why we're doing the delete all?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The original House File 2705 is designed to exempt licensed attorneys and employees of licensed attorneys from having to be licensed for as a closing agent. What the DE1 amendment does, and this was proposed by the Department of Commerce, is it exempts other professions that are also strictly regulated and licensed in ways that should cover the closing agent type duties.
Okay, thank you. Members, any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Thank you, Representative Mazerall, to the bill as amended.
And actually, I think I've pretty much described the bill already, Mr. Chair, but I do have with me Brian Lake to testify regarding its need.
Thank you, Mr. Lake. If you would like to identify yourself for the record and enlighten us, we would appreciate it.
Sure. Brian Lake, representing the Minnesota State Bar Association. Actually, Mr. Chair, perhaps it would be a bit more appropriate to have the Department of Commerce comment on the amendment. Since it's far more expansive than the original bill.
Thank you, Mr. Lake. Welcome back, Mr. Reich. Tell us what we need to know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. John Reich, Department of Commerce. Mr. Chair, a couple of years ago, I think the department had a bill. I know they had a bill, and what I think it did was change some things around in Chapter 82, and we got our cross-references crossed during that time. And so you'll notice in Section 2 of the DE1 amendment, there is a number of entities who had been under law for a number of years exempt from licensure as a real estate broker when acting as a closing agent. The cross-reference mix-up that happened when we changed around Chapter 82 took that exemption away from folks, and so the attorneys noticed that, came with a fix, and we thought we'd just simply fix it for that entire section, not just, and the attorneys are included in that section, Mr. Chair, and so it gets us back to where the law always should have been.
So thank you for the explanation, Mr. Reich, and I assume that that means that you have been working with the author and that you're good with everything that he and Mr. Lake have done?
Mr. Chair and members, that's true.
Thank you. Members, any questions for Mr. Lake, Representative Mazerall, or Mr. Reich? Anybody else in the audience want to speak for or against this bill? Seeing nobody rushing down, Representative Mazerall, good work. You get the brevity award for the day so far. With that, Representative Mazerall, if you want to give us a final word, or you don't have to, and renew your motion, and we'll go ahead and vote.
I renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Mazerall renews his motion on House File 2705 as amended. It would be recommended to pass and go to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mazerall and Mr. Lake.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes.
Representative Atkins. Hello, Representative Atkins.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Please, if you want to go ahead and move House File 2633 and start whenever you're ready.
I would like to move House File 2633 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill, Mr. Chair. It is my understanding that I may be joined here today by someone from the Minnesota Grape Growers Association and perhaps others. What this bill does is it allows for some bulk wine purchased by farm wineries. And I don't, doesn't appear that I'm going to get any help today, so I'm going to do my best to explain it, Mr. Chairman. And then the good news, come on down. The provision would allow for mostly to balance out the availability of certain juices and grapes throughout Minnesota's growing season, as you might in, well, actually, this growing season has probably been a year-round growing season.
We're about ready for harvest next weekend, I think.
I suspect so, but what this would enable Minnesota's farm wineries to do is purchase a small amount, 10% of bulk wine, so that it would even out some of the ups and downs in the industry. It's we've had a very robust, thriving farm winery, not just the wine that they create, but the tourism that they promote. It's a growing industry, a very attractive industry, and one that we want to see succeed. And hopefully this would level out some of the bumps that they experienced during the course of the Minnesota's growing season. And with that, I am joined by somebody who I believe will share some additional thoughts. And it's my understanding, Mr. Chairman, there are some concerns about the bill as well, and I'm pleased that we'll have an opportunity to hear from the testifiers and then consider what might be best to put in a liquor omnibus bill. And thank you.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you could identify yourself for the record and start when you're ready.
Mark Wedge.
Sorry, could you spell your last name?
Wedge, W-E-D-G-E.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, I co-own a winery in Redwood Falls, Minnesota. I'm on the board of directors for Minnesota Grape Growers Association. I'm the liaison between the MGGA and the Minnesota Farm Winery Association, and I serve on the government affairs committees for both organizations. What the proposed bill would like to happen is for this to be a small tool used within the 49% allowed for out-of-state juice, grapes, mead, or other fruits used for the production of wine. It would not be in excess of the 49%. It would be part of that 49%. So the goal is to always stay a majority Minnesota grown and produced. We vetted this with the MLBA and the MMBA, and it's my understanding that there is no opposition. Hopefully that still stands. I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any regarding why this is a necessary tool.
Well, if you could give the committee just a little bit of background on why the 49% is in law, and I think we all know Representative Atkins, I think, did a nice job of explaining that, but just for the members that haven't heard it, just kind of give us a little bit from your perspective the current state of the wineries in Minnesota.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, members. The current law states that the majority of production needs to be Minnesota grown. If there are years when that is not possible, one can file for an affidavit and increase their production beyond that 51%. This year may be a great example. As you walk around these nice weather, it's great for us, but not so great for grapevines. There's a high likelihood that we'll experience bud break in the next couple of weeks, a higher likelihood that sometime in the next 60 days we'll see a killing frost. So, again, this is part of the 49% importation. It gives us a variety of tools outside of Minnesota, but I think one of the real important things is it also gives us a tool in-state, the ability to move wine bond-to-bond, Minnesota-grown, which we can't do currently. It's legal to sell it, not legal to buy it. So in my area, if we have don't have any issues because we have our risk spread quite broad, but a winery in this size state does have issues, we have wine to sell them.
I don't want to get too far afield, but I'm curious. If we get buds that come out and then we do get a frost, is there anything you can do about that? Can you go around pour water on every little bud or something like that? Is there any mechanism to try to save those vines?
Mr. Chairman, there are a lot of email chatter right now within our industry. There are some things one can do, pruning methods, applicants, but the reality is they might extend bud break 5 to 7 days. 2010 was a great example. We're kind of mirroring that year right now, real nice March and April, and then a very normal Mother's Day frost. I think it was estimated in 2010 about 40% of the state's grape production was lost. The vines will survive. New growth will continue. Secondary buds will produce some fruit. It's not like an apple tree where you lose that blossom and the harvest is lost, but it is going to be significantly less than what we would expect.
So thank you. Representative Atkins.
Mr. Wedge, let's assume that on the the southern portion of the state. We don't experience that freeze, but in the northern portion we do. Would this legislation help those northern growers in some fashion? And if so, how?
Mr. Wesch.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkins, it would, in addition to having the tool to bring stuff in from out of state, now the detractors from this are going to assume that everything's going to come out of California or New York, and that's simply not the case. I foresee the majority of wine being moved around in bulk is Minnesota wineries bond to bond in state. Outside of that, there is going to be wineries that say they're short on a cold climate varietal. They can look to Wisconsin, they can look to Iowa or the Dakotas to help source that. And I think the reality is if a winery chooses to take advantage of this and bring 10% of their production in from, say, California and bottle up a California cab, my customers anyway are going to see right through that. That's not what they want to see. But to utilize it as a blending mechanism to be able to move wine in-state, cold climate wine around to wineries that are short or wineries that are new to the operation, don't have a grower network, that's where this is really going to pay dividends to the industry.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I was interrupted by another member with a question. So if this was covered, you can just talk to me offline. But just curious about the use of bulk wine. I guess, I'm familiar with grapes being brought and that, but actual fermented product. Is that common in winemaking? I guess it's just not something I was familiar with.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loon, industry-wide, yes, it is. Most states have no regulation against the importation of wine. Many states go so far as to say you can bring in what we in the industry call shiners, which is something that's bottled elsewhere. You're bringing it into
your
facility. It
might be bad, but it sounds fun.
Slap a label on it and call it your own. That is not what we're talking about here. This is a tool for blending, a tool to move wine around in-state that is consistent with cold climate and the culture that we're trying to promote and grow.
Other questions, members? Otherwise, is there anyone else that wants, I think Mr. Rockler is here, that wants to speak to this. Is there anyone else that wants to speak for or against this bill? Mr. Rockler, welcome to the committee. Whenever you're ready, identify yourself for the tape, and please proceed.
Chairman Hoppe, members of the committee, my name is Ken Rockler, and I'm the executive director of the Tavern League of Minnesota. And I have been, I guess, involved off and on with the farm winery bill for some time. I want to make sure that everybody understands that this is a far leap from what's in the current farm winery bill. The reason the provision has always been in there, at least it's always been said to me by both public safety and members of the legislature, that allowed outstate grapes, grape juice, honey, or other fruit bases to come in was in case of crop failure. We, representing retailers, and I believe to a certain extent some wholesalers, have never really had a problem with it. We weren't that comfortable with it, but we understood that the investment in Minnesota viticulture and wine producing required some type of fallback in case of a freeze or a crop. As I read this bill, we're going way beyond that right now. We're talking about bringing in bulk wine. We're not talking about juice, pulp, honey, or mead. And I would say that, contrary to a prior testimony, I think there are a lot of people right now that are buying California or Oregon or Washington juice and thinking it is Minnesota juice. As far back as 18 years ago, I was at the Chanhassen Legion, coincidentally, and two people wanted me to come over and taste their wine that was such a great Minnesota product. I looked at it, and I said, wait a minute, this isn't Minnesota wine, and I'm not a silver palate or anything at that point. So there is juice being brought in already that I think kind of goes against what the intent of the law was. I would ask that this bill be laid over at least for another week until some information that I requested yesterday from the Department of Public Safety is available. As I understand the procedure, and possibly the author or one of the members of the other, the wine growers group could contradict me. I might not be right, but I think the procedure each year is that if there's a crop failure, they go to the Department of Public Safety. And then at that point, the Department of Public Safety concurs with the University of Minnesota Enology Department. I have to say that I think it's probably been abused already, even when it's supposed to be just fruit, grapes, grape juice. And the best example I can give is actually not grapes, which is the major product that I think that the retailers are worried about. If you have a crop failure in apples and you go and get Washington apples or Northern California, Oregon apples, that kind of makes sense. You're replacing the same fruit. If you've got somebody that's trying to make mango wine and they wonder why each year there's a crop failure in mangoes, it's a little bit unrealistic. But rather than me conjecture on that, public safety told me that it would take them about 3 or 4 days, but they could get the records on what's gone on in the past. I don't know if anybody has any questions of me.
Representative Davids has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just maybe something more procedurally. We have deadlines coming up. I don't want this bill to... It's going to make it in the Senate? Okay. I just don't want to hold it up because when Mr. Rockler said wait for a week, I don't want to have that as a technique to kill it, but if it's made in the Senate, we're okay there.
Yeah, Representative Davids, the intention is to lay this over and hopefully have it be part of the omnibus liquor bill. Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if Representative Adkins or the testifier could answer this question, but I was just thinking through, I was looking at the shall not exceed 10% of their production. Let's say I wanted to bring in bulk wine from wherever, California. Would this allow me to take bulk wine of whatever variety, pour it in a bottle, relabel it, and sell it without doing anything to that?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stensrud, that was one of the issues that I was hoping would be addressed during the course of the hearing. That would be a concern that I'd want to make sure that we, and that's part of the reason why I like the way that the liquor bill works. You know, we have the bill heard, we lay it over, we see what, and what Mr. Rackler referred to in terms of information from DPS, I think is going to be very helpful as well, as will an answer to your question. So that's my way of saying I don't really know for sure right now, but
thank you.
I don't think that's the intent of the bill.
Representative Atkinson, do you want to come up and speak to this point? And Mr. Rockler, go ahead.
I just wanted to point out that as currently written in 340A 315 subdivision 4, which deals with Minnesota products, it's if Minnesota produced or grown grapes, grape juice, other fruit bases, or honey is not available, you're really not allowed to bring in bulk wine. I suspect it's been going on, but I don't know that for a fact. Just to give you an idea, though, about the amount of product, you're not talking about a small amount of wine. It allows 50,000 gallons. That's 20 semis or 22,000 cases. That's more than many small wholesalers sell in an entire year right now. So just to get everything straight here at this point, that's why we're a little concerned about where we're going with this.
Hey, Representative Atkins, I think we have somebody behind you that wants to speak to this issue as well.
Are you done? Do you want to? I'm done. Listen, anybody has any questions?
Members, any questions? Any other questions for Mr. Rockler?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rockler. We appreciate it. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you could identify yourself for the record and help us out how you can.
My name is Jim Arlt. I'm a senior special agent for the state of Minnesota, the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. Mr. Rockler was correct in the essence of that there is, as far as a 50,000 gallon wine provision, as far as for farm wineries, but that's, I believe, in total. We have heard.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but when you mean in total, are you talking in total for the
license.
State or for one per license?
For their license. Yes, sir. And then as we go through some of the other, one of the things that he ended up asking for, and hopefully this will end up being able to help clarify for him and for the committee, is that we do receive wine affidavits or affidavits from farm wineries, from crop failures, from an early frost that hurt their buds. Over the last 5 years, in 2011, we received them from four farm wineries, 2010 from three farm wineries, from 2009, four farm wineries, 2008, four, 2007, two. One of our farm wineries have requested this or filed a wine affidavit four of the five of the last 5 years. Five of the same farm wineries have used this in the last 2 years. And part of that is geographical. We have frost in different areas of the state. Different varieties of wine are a little bit more susceptible to that. When we receive the affidavit, we do check and end up trying to find out whether there is a lack of that particular grape varietal around. So open any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Arnold. Members, any questions? Mr. Arnold, I'll ask, generally speaking, are we on the right track with this? And do you think this is going to greatly disrupt our farm wine industry in the state?
I don't know that it, Mr. Chair and members, I don't know that it necessarily goes completely off track. Clarity on the provision that it in statute that it's to be used to be blended and not just bottled might be appropriate. And then with that it is clear that it is part of that 49.999% that they can do without an affidavit might be appropriate. But as far as the public safety provision, we're fairly neutral as far as the bill goes. We are aware of the concept of some farm wineries possibly buying bulk prior to this.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate it. Did you want to come down and speak to this, sir? Come on down. Please identify yourself for the record and start whenever you're ready.
My name is Matt Scott. Pretty easy, two first names. I'm on the board of directors for the Minnesota Grape Growers. I am a grape grower myself, and I'm also the general manager of a winery out in Stillwater. The first proposition of this was to limit it to Minnesota only, but one of the problems we've seen in a few other states is with a federal ruling by the Supreme Court for Granholm, and you guys might be familiar with some of this. And we were worried that would be a problem. We already have the regulation of 49%, 51%, and we assumed that this would all live within those constraints. Currently, you can go and find wineries that are purchasing fruit from California, but the scare, I think, of buying bulk California wine for resale isn't really legitimate. If you go to your liquor store, you can buy a $7 or $8 cab. If you buy a bulk cab in Minnesota, you're probably going to lose money selling it at $7 or $8, so you're not competitive. You have a lot of shipping fees. That's not what we're going for here. What we're really looking for is transferring of bulk material from, let's say, a winery in southern Minnesota that doesn't go through a frost episode to a winery in northern Minnesota. There's wineries as far north as the Duluth area. There's a few people, I think, that have filed for a license, Two Fools, Leroy Stump's winery. So we're just looking for a method to evenly distribute. My winery actually is not really interested. We're neutral on the bill, but we're part of a wine industry that's growing. When our winery started, there were only three wineries. We were the third. There were a couple hundred acres of vineyard. Now there's several thousand. This is an industry that is growing. It's producing a lot of tourism revenue. So I find this to be a helpful tool in assisting some of my fellow winemakers and growers. If you increase a little bit of extra out-of-state wine that maybe you weren't buying before, you have to supplement with more in-state. So it's going to push our local growth of grape growing as well.
Thank you, Mr. Scott. Members, any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for helping shed some more light on this. Is there anyone else here that wants to come down and speak for or against this bill? Mr. Wedge, come on down. Mr. Bagnoli, do you want to speak to this?
Mark Wedge. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Just wanted to make one point of clarification. The per license cap is 50,000 gallons, but let's put this in perspective. The largest winery in state is producing about 15,000 gallons annually. So we are actually talking about a relatively small amount. When you consider the average winery is less than 5,000 gallons, again, it's a small tool to help out. It's part of the 49%. We're not asking for more than that. I guess, personally, I wouldn't have a problem if there was language that suggested it be for blending. No issue with that.
Thank you. I'm not seeing any more questions or anybody else that wants to speak to this issue. Representative Atkins, do you want the final word before we lay this over?
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, there's one topic that seems to come up again and again. We didn't introduce a bill because it's kind of perceived to be, but it's on this very topic, and that is, you know, we call these farm wineries, and I think every time somebody calls me or they call you or they call Mr. McCormick, we tell them that, you know, and they ask where they can do one of these farm wineries, we tell them on agricultural property.
Mm-hmm.
It's come to my attention that we don't actually have that in the statute, and I just wanted to bring it to members' attention. We may, I didn't want to put it in the liquor omnibus bill without at least throwing out as, you know, that's something that maybe we should have in statute at some point, so these truly are farm wineries, at least for new ones, not the ones that are underway today. If anybody has a violent reaction to that or thoughts on that topic, please share them with me. And we'll be in the process now over the next several days of putting together the omnibus liquor bill.
Representative Atkins, I think that's interesting. I didn't know that. I just assumed. And, of course, no one here will tell anybody on the Ag Committee, but maybe we want to leave that sort of vague and let people put wineries wherever they want to.
Like in my basement or yours, Mr. Chairman. But it's just something for the Commerce Committee I wanted to share with that. Mr. Chair, I'd renew my motion that House File 2633 be laid over for potential inclusion in the liquor omnibus bill.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody that testified. It was an interesting discussion. With that, I did not announce this before, but we are not going to hear Representative Grunhagen's 2349. That is still a work in progress. We're going to go back to House File 2347, and I appreciate everybody's indulgence in letting us temporarily lay that over so Representative Grunhagen could go vote in whatever committee that was. And with that, Representative Grunhagen, I don't remember where we were, but
I don't either. So,
I think we are.
Let's get
House File 2347 back. I will take that off the table, get it back in front of us. Is there anyone in the audience that wants to come down and speak for or against House File 2347? And I believe we amended that earlier. I think we did it as a lead all. Members, any further questions? Representative Loon.
Did you vote on the amendment?
I think we did put the amendment on.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question, and this might be for Mr. Pender, actually. You know, we did legislation in previous years to state that small employers, and I think the last reiteration of this was up to 100 employees, could purchase health insurance without all the mandates in that we require. It allowed some flexibility. Would this legislation impinge upon that at all?
Mr. Pender?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loon, I hadn't thought about that, but what Section 2 of this bill does is just deal with the premiums for the group from 51 to 100 and not the content of the policy.
Thank you, Mr. Pender. Representative Loon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pender, well, that was my understanding, and again, I'm not an attorney and not as learned as you are in this area of the law, but it would be my assumption that it would not affect that. You're nodding your head, so I'm going to take that as a yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Loon. Members, other questions? And Representative Grunhagen, this is section 2 is where we did the oral amendment earlier on the delete all, and then we adopted the delete all. Are you, have you been in the interim here when we were hearing the farm winery bill, have you been discussing section 2 with various parties, the Commerce Department and Mr. McLaren and things? Did you reach any conclusion on that?
Yeah, I think we will be able to work out our difficulty between now and the HHS committee.
So we leave section 2 in. You're going to take care of that between now and HHS. Representative Atkins, is that? Thank you. And members, any questions, any concerns with that? Thank you, Representative Grunhagen and Mr. McLaren and others for working on that. With that, I don't remember who originally moved it. I think it was me. Seeing no further questions, is there anybody else that wants to testify on this? Not seeing anyone. I will renew my motion that House File 2347, as amended, be recommended to pass and go to the Committee on HHS Reform. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you,
and
Mr.
members.
Chairman.
With that, members, we are adjourned, and we will see you all here tomorrow. Thank you.